Hello, and welcome to the AHN podcast. I'm your host, Chinwa Denye. In this episode, we will be in conversation with Stanley Onyemechalu. Stanley is a Gates Cambridge Scholar and PhD candidate in archaeology at King's College, University of Cambridge, UK. He recently received the university's Vice Chancellor Award for research impact and engagement as runner-up in the early career research category for his research which explores the intersections of cultural heritage and the legacies of violent conflicts in the context of the Nigerian Civil War of 1967 to 1970. We will be discussing the legacies of Biafra Heritage Project, which is the public engagement aspect of his research. Hello, Stanley. Thanks for joining me today. Can you share a bit about your background and what inspired this research?
Thank you so much for having me, Sean. So I am a Nigerian of Igbo origin, and even though I was born in Lagos, at the start of my secondary school age, my father wanted me to go back to the East to, according to him, learn about the culture and not just, you know, be this Lagos or Omoibo or something like that. And so while I was in the East, which is where I also like did my secondary and my undergraduate degrees as well, I always heard people refer to the war, especially the older generation, when they were talking about, just you ask them some kind of questions and they say, oh, before the war, XYZ, or after the war, XYZ. Or if not for the war, you know, so everything just sort of revolved around the war. It was this temporal marker in the way they approached the past. And up until that point, I hadn't heard about the war, not even from my parents. You know, and so I just was very inquisitive about what it was, what it meant, and why it had this much value that, you know, everybody wanted to refer to it. So that was really how the interest in the Biafra War actually came to be planted in my mind. At the time, I didn't know that I would go on to study it like full-fledged as my PhD degree. But when the opportunity presented itself during my master's degree at the University of Nigeria, I was like, yeah, why not? So I studied a bit of it from after my literature review. I studied a bit of it from the cultural heritage perspective in Nsukka itself, because while people were talking about the war, you hear a great deal about Nsukka, especially because of the university there and the activities of the Nigerian soldiers there, but also because of the activities of the so-called Biafran intellectuals that sprung out of that particular institution. So I wanted to understand how the broader community were impacted by the war. And so I did my thesis on that, my master's thesis on that. And I remember my supervisor at the time saying, hey, this is like really good work. And if you like, you could take this up to the PhD level and you just have to broaden your scope, you know. So beyond Nsukka, what about pick several states in the Southeast or several communities across the Southeast and all of that? And true to his words, I did exactly that. I started hunting for PhD opportunities abroad. And unlike some of my colleagues that had like some kind of open-ended cold emails, you know, where you say, oh, I can work on any project, these are my experiences, here's my CV, I was actually saying, I want to work on the Biafra War. This is my proposal on this particular topic. But if you don't like it, then we could talk about something else. But I was always like leading with that. Ultimately, I got to come to Cambridge. So I think that's really the background and how I got to start working on the Biafra War as my project.
I'd met you in person before seeing this publication of your award. So when I saw it, I was curious, what's the significance of the award? What's this award about? I understand it's a runner-up in the early career research. What does this mean, really? Why should anybody look forward to such an award, to be honest?
Yeah, definitely. So the University of Cambridge has this university-wide awards that they do every year with different levels. So the award is for research impact and engagement. So it rewards the most innovative or the best research projects that involve groundbreaking, innovative and collaborative efforts in the way they approach their projects. So not only does it have to be groundbreaking and innovative, it also has to be collaborative. So you have to have done some aspect of public engagement, because that's something that we lack in academia, or we had been lacking in academia until recently. So universities around the world are trying to push that aspect of academic work to make sure that communities are not left out and are not just seen as subjects or the objects to be studied, but that they are also involved in these cutting edge research that we're doing in these kinds of institutions. So they instituted that award just for that particular thing. And it has three categories. There's the established academic category. So it's for professors, I think people with 10 years teaching experience or higher tenure or something like that. Like, it's really mostly professors you see in that particular category, or even doctors who have been in the academic environment for a long time. And then there's the early career category, which is really the most competitive category, because the way they define early career is between a PhD student right up until a PhD holder, say in the last 8 years or 7 years, something like that. So
that's a wide gap.
Yeah, that's a wide range of people. I mean, candidates, when you looked at the... So, they said there was a 50% jump or increase in the number of applications just in that category as well. So not only is it the most competitive, it's also like the most subscribed. Like, people send a lot of stuff there. And of course, there are lots of PhD students, and then there are lots of postdocs, and then there are lots of like young lecturers who also have their PhDs. So it's really this big category. And then the final category is the what they call the collaborative category. And it's just a way to say collaborations within the university, so within the academic and non-academic staff of the university. So, for example, if I'm already hired as an academic, say a lecturer, and I do a collaborative project with some museum in Cambridge as well, those museum staff, they don't teach, they don't, you know, they just do museum stuff. So they are kind of non-academic in some sense. That would fall under that category, you know. So, that was really what the award, I think, was about, and what that ECR category meant.
Wow. Congratulations again. Actually, it's pretty big deal for the competition within that category. Congrats again. All right, so let me go into the research itself and the methodology. I mean, I've done a bit of research, or I'm involved in research one way or the other. And there are certain challenges that I find with doing research when it comes to Nigerian stories or conversations. I just want to know how you went about First of all, the biggest challenges that you faced in curating the materials for the project, and then how you went about collecting the oral stories, the archival materials for the project.
Okay, I'll start with how I collected the data and then maybe talk about the challenges after. The LBHP on its own, actually, maybe I should start out with that clarification, is my public engagement segment of the entire PhD, project. Like the PhD thesis, is its own thing. And then the LBHP is an offshoot of that. So it's really how I get to engage with these communities that I'm working with through different activities, workshops, and promotional materials, the website, just trying to get them to see what I'm doing at the aspects that everybody can understand, something we call democratizing knowledge, if you will. So, but I'll answer the question as a collective, because while doing the PhD and curating the material for the PhD, I'm also doing the public engagement wing of it. And it was mostly ethnography. So, staying and embedding myself with these communities, interviews, long form interviews, or what we call in-depth interviews. Some of them were key informant led, so like people who played key roles during the war or possessed some kind of key significance, so maybe a king or a traditional ruler, a community leader, kind of interviews, or curator at the National War Museum, for example, in Umuahia. So it was a mix of different kinds of interviews. Some of them were very short as well, because you start talking and maybe they just want to stop sharing, or there's very little to glean from that. So it's really not so straightforward. But the bulk of it, yes, were very lengthy, because it was mostly unstructured as well. So I just let them talk and talk and lead me, or lead, just allow the data lead me through the research, rather than trying to get them to talk about what I'm just interested in. Which, I mean, has its own pros and cons, but it was really, really helpful, because then things I never thought I could find, I started finding. I'm like, oh wow, can you say a little more about that? Or, can you elaborate on this? So that was like the biggest method with which I collected most of my data, just ethnography. And then I did lots of site visits. So when people mention certain places, I try to find those places, and see what I can find, if there are still material traces, or physical traces rather. I'll visit such places if it's inaccessible, then I just say, oh well, I get the story around the place and then I leave. And then archives, I majored in the National Archives in Enugu, the National Archives of Nigeria, Enugu, I think it's called. And they have like troves, treasure troves of documents concerning the Civil War. It's just too much,
Wow, interesting.
especially if one is a historian. I think they would find a lot of value in just the amount of things that were documented. Like you have just in the newspaper section, you see like the Biafra Times, like newspapers that originated from that region while while it existed, and then also some foreign media newspapers. Find some artworks by some artists or cartoonists that's just the newspaper section, and then you see some correspondences, letters, minutes of meetings. Then the propaganda area, you know, for the Radio Biafra at the time, transcripts of their broadcasts or their interviews on air, adverts or message to boost morale. It's a lot. You just need to know what you're looking for. Spend a lot of time because, people at National Archives, and shout out to them. They're very, very methodical in what they do. Even though it can be slow, it's government work, but they are very professional. Like they know what it is. And then you just need to be patient, come back when they ask you to come back. Lots of photocopying and all that. So that was like another source of information gathering for me as well.
It's interesting to hear you say that the National Archives in Enugu is quite, that they were quite helpful and that you could find a lot of things there. As a side note, what's the condition of the archives? What do you think? In terms of temperature and all of that, just the preservation of those the materials there. What do you?
Yeah, I think they're in a very precarious state. They are threatened by all kinds of, everything, including weather, pests. Mishandling, or it's threatened. Every time I go back, things are further deteriorated. Sometimes what you found before may have been misplaced or miscategorized or something, and you just have to start all over again. Which isn't helpful if you do not know what you're looking for. If you know what you're looking for, then of course you could guide, them, and you could find certain documents. So it's mostly funding. It lacks funding from the government. There's little attention being paid to those buildings. So I mean, it could also do with lots of digitization. I was asking one of the staff members there if they've applied for grants to digitize a lot of their records, and I think at the time they didn't even know that certain grants existed. And I tried to write down a couple of them that I found online, but I don't know how that process went. But the point is, it's in a very dire state, and they need a lot of help, especially digitizing those records, because you can keep those documents for just, no matter how you try to keep them safe, even in a refrigerator or something, they will still deteriorate at some point. So maybe digitizing them is the best form of preserving them, I think.
Great, thank you. The cultural heritage world is moving in that direction. Hopefully our listeners will pick it up as a project, approach the National Archives. I understand there's one in Ibadan as well, and I think one in Kaduna. Perhaps.
I think I've heard that the one in Ibadan is sort of looks better. And the person telling me was saying it might be because it is situated within the university, and so they there's a lot of knowledge exchange that can happen just because you're situated within the university environment. So that might be it. I don't know. But I think all of them just need attention.
Thank you. So just going into the project itself, like you said, that the LBHP is the public engagement side of your project. And I wanted us to just talk a bit about the project itself, the insights you got from it. Were there any particularly moving or surprising discoveries in the whole process?
The some of the stories, some of the narratives that I received were very, very fascinating, and some of them were like, it was the first time even for many Igbo people as well. You know, when I present sometimes at certain conferences, they're also like surprised to hear of certain things that are connected to the Biafra War that they didn't know about until that presentation. So, I'm also very young, so I didn't know much apart from like the myths and some little histories that we heard in passing, or you know, in certain other aspects. So yeah, they were just, especially this cultural heritage angle. I think a lot of the Biafra has been studied politically, historically. So like the social history, the politics of it, the I think some have also looked at the economics of it, like its relationship or impact on the oil sector, especially in the South South regions and all that. Just the 20 pounds policy and economic post-war economic reconstructions in the Southeast and all of that. But I don't think a lot of people have talked about the cultural heritage aspect of it. So that was even, I think, the biggest reason there was lots of eye-popping answers or findings during my research. Even for some of the interviewees, they'd be like, "Oh, wow, that's such a good question. Nobody has asked me this before," you know, because you're looking for things that are, I mean, they seem so ordinary or they are not even there until you start digging a bit, and then people open up and you're like, "Wow." You know, so I think maybe one example I can share is food, how the war impacted food ways, for example, in the Southeast, or just within the Igbo communities. You know, certain foods that weren't so popular or even significant in certain aspects of Igbo land, for example, in the Nsukka area, Enugu-Ezike in particular. They didn't really care much about abacha. It's some kind of local African salad, I think it's called these days. I mean, everybody planted cassava, but they made other things from it, either gari or fufu, that's apple, you know, or other derivatives. But abacha wasn't really popular in those parts of Igbo land until the war, you know. And then during the war, people found that, wow, this was not just, I mean, it was easy to prepare, easier to, I mean, before you make apple or gari, you need like all these processes and processing that were almost impossible during the war, you know. But to make abacha, it was simpler, and it was like dry food, so you could run with it for days without thinking about whether it's gonna spoil. It was also lightweight, so you could carry it as well. So I mean, abacha was just one thing. I remember many of the women and some men in that part of Igbo land were telling me that they came to rediscover, not like discover for the first time, but just reappreciate and sort of begin to cherish because of the war. And then there's stockfish, which is, I think, has become a mainstay in every Igbo delicacy and kind of especially soups, you know. Yeah, that's it becoming a mainstay has a lot of traces to the war as well, because that was how a lot of the relief agencies were sending salt to that region, you know, during the economic blockade of what was Biafra. There was hunger, you know, the pictures of Kwashiorkor children and malnourished children that went around the world was as a result of that blockade. So when it was sort of loosened up a bit for relief materials to come in through the Red Cross and church missionary societies and other agencies. They laced the codfish with salt to be able to bring salt to a lot of those malnourished children, you know. So that was how stockfish came and, you know, came to just become this thing. And there are pictures of children in those camps carrying fish or stockfish, you know, around. And I mean, just if you look at foodways, there are lots and lots of things that you could just talk about in terms of how that war impacted, you know, that. So
right.
I think that's one thing that surprised me.
Okay. I see from the website that you had a contest, art contest, and exhibitions and all of that. I wonder if you can share some memorable submissions from the art contest and how or what they reveal about contemporary perceptions of the Biafra War.
Yeah, that's such a good question. So first of all, I think overall the contest, so it was like two phases. First, wanted to know before they did the contest what they knew at all about the Biafra War, because, you know, the history has been suppressed in schools. History has been interrupted, you know. Today it's in, tomorrow it's out, today it's in, tomorrow it's out. And even when it's in the curriculum, you pick up the syllabus and not enough not enough attention is regarded to the Civil War. They just talk about Kanem Bornu Empire, Sokoto Empire, Ife, Ibuku, all those things, and then they jump into independence. We got our independence, and then they jump into the military coups, coup one, coup two, coup three. You know, nobody really talks about the war until, you know, democracy in 1999 and today. So I wanted to know what these young people between 16 and 35 knew about the war, you know. So in the absence of proper war history, how else, like, what did they know anything about the war? And so the questionnaire showed that they knew about just about the war in terms of, you know, the Biafra War that it happened, but there was basically very little knowledge about what happened, why, how, who, and what else, you know. And also the first phase also revealed that, oh, a lot of that information came from parents and elders rather than school lessons or movies or books. You know, so we then took them to the second phase of the contest, which was the art one. And in the art contest, they were asked to do both. They were asked to do three tasks, depending on which one they felt comfortable with. The first was you could paint or draw what you remember or what you know about the Biafra War. Or you could do a poem, or you could write a short story. So those were the three categories that we gave them. And I remember the most striking ones were the paintings, you know, maybe because it's just it resonates visually and I can quickly remember. One person drew, and of course you don't need to be a perfect artist, you know, so people are really picking up paint and brush, like some of them said, for the first time, you know, after fine arts in school or something. So we weren't looking for anything too aesthetically pleasing. We're just looking for the ideas, the sense behind it, you know. And they were given a chance to also explain what they thought they were drawing or what they wanted to draw as well. And one of them, I think the winning piece, drew something like her grandmother and her grandmother and her aunt with her mother. So her grandmother was pregnant during the war with her mother.
Oh, wow.
And two other daughters, you know, during the war. I think they lost one of the young girls while they were running or something like that. But her mom, who was like still in the stomach at the time, made it and of course gave birth to her. So she said that's like a story that sort of resonates in their household anytime the war comes up, you know, talk about how they lost their aunt, and how their mom, you know, is like this survivor. I mean, their grandma is like the survivor, but even her mom, who was like still in the belly at the time, like a double survivor or some sort. So it was such a touching imagery as well, you know, and just the way she explained it. I remember that was powerful.
Interesting.
And one other guy actually drew the a kwashiorkor child, you know, with a protruding stomach and a palm tree. Like those were the two things on his drawing, his paper. And I said, why just the palm tree? And of course, I understand the protruding stomach is making reference to the kwashiorkor children, but the palm tree, I think he was saying that the palm tree signified, I mean, of course, the palm tree is a very important part of the Igbo culture. You know, yeah, it has a lot of significance, and there's a lot of proverbs and just festivals and things that revolve around the palm tree. So he said that that was like those children maybe didn't think that they would survive, and maybe that palm tree was like a sign of hope and restoration and regeneration and all of that. You know, so these were powerful. Yeah, there were lots of powerful imagery in those paintings.
Interesting. I wonder, did you, during the dialogues when you were having conversations, I want to ask, did you have conversations that or exchanges between the young and the old? So survivors themselves and people who weren't part of it, what were the most surprising and impactful exchanges that went on between these two sets of people?
I mean, I think of everything, the dialogues were my most favorite. I call them the intergenerational dialogues, because, you know, precisely they were conducted in a way that we had people across generations talking to each other just about the war. And in one particular occasion, I think during the finale of the entire LBHP project, which is, you know, the Legacies of Biafra Heritage Project, by the way, for your listeners. During the finale, which was the same day we launched the exhibition, we had another intergenerational dialogue, because that day we had school children. Formerly, we just had the participants from the contest, the 16 to 35, you know, age range, and then war survivors. That was like how we've been running those dialogues in the past. But on the day of the exhibition launch, we had school children. We had just regular people like youths, you know. And yeah, it was like a multi-generational kind of audience. So it was interesting to see that there is really a divide in the way the war is perceived or remembered across generations. And I think maybe the best way to summarize it is a lot of the older generation, a lot of overwhelmingly, do not want another war to happen. In fact, they are most interested in just having a peaceful coexistence, trying to sort things out in a civil, you know, with discussions and you know, diplomatic, you know, routes, you know, exchanges, dialogues, and other approaches. Whereas there was a lot of sort of radical views from the younger generation.
Agitation,
you know? Yeah, there was a lot
typical of young people.
You know, Yeah, the answers kind of generation. That thing they said, yeah, say they know the hell word or something. There was a way they always said that thing. But yeah, it was evident. It was really evident. In fact, at some point, there was a shouting match between some guy. I think he was around 32 or so, and one of the war veterans. I mean, this guy fought in the trenches, and he was singing some of the songs. Like earlier, he was telling us a lot of the experience he had, and how sometimes when a plane or something is flying very low, he still feels like very scared, like visibly shaking, from the experience. And so he was, I mean, I think the guy was sounding too radical for him, and he stood up and was going to approach him to yeah, that was, I think, the most striking moment during that dialogue was, because I was in the middle of them. I have this picture of somebody captured that moment where I was in the middle of them, and the guy was with the microphone spitting all these, we should do this, we should have done that. If we do it this way, this would have done that, fire and thunder and all of that. And this man is like, "You haven't seen war, my child. You need to calm yourself down and look at other ways that you could manage this." I think a lot of them agreed that the marginalization was still a current issue. So, like, nothing much has changed from why Ojukwu went to war in 1967. But there were very, very stark differences in what to do about it, or how to go about it. I think that was the most striking aspect of those exchanges.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. It's understandable. Young people, I think we're usually like that. We think that being fiery and aggressive about things changes things. But there's a Yoruba adage about he who hasn't been to war is who calls himself a man. Until you experience it, really. You never know.
Agree.
Anyways. So I know that you also had like a Dancing Memories exhibition. How did that, what was that about? What was the significance and how did it contribute to the understanding of the war legacies?
Yeah, actually, it was a play on words with that particular. So the Dancing Memories exhibition was the name of the entire exhibition. So the exhibition was about us showcasing a lot of the artworks from the art contest, as well as powerful quotes from the poems and the short stories, and then some aspects of the phase one, like results from the questionnaires that I shared across the region. But how dance even came at all in that title was because something else I found was very surprising was a dance that was created during the war. Again, in some parts of Nsukka, where Nsukka is very key, like I explained in the beginning, but also because it was at a border. It's a border town. Between the Igbo and, say, the Igala, I think, or the Idoma, so that meant, when Biafra was declared, they were also the border between Biafra and Nigeria, as it were, which again also meant that when the Nigerian forces invaded, Nsukka was hit first and fast, and for a long time. As the war went on, Nsukka was in limbo. It was like sort of a recaptured territory. So they didn't know whether they would win, whether they would be Biafrans or Nigerians at the end of the day. So for like more than 2.5 years, as the war went on in other parts, Nsukka was like already done and dusted for the Nigerian side, if you get what I mean. But the war was still on, so that meant things didn't just return to normal, you know, as it were. So there was lots of military checkpoints and just, people talk about some abuses and just like there was a huge policing of the area. But in spite of all of that, there was this community that it started out as a song to some kind of social commentary or something we call njakiri, you know, like sarcasm, where they were trying to, well, at first just to mock somebody they called Godi, who had this well, like a well that collected water during the rainy season or something, and people could draw from it. Yeah, during the dry season. So, according to them, the father of the guy went to the front lines to fight, and so the guy was just this young chap that was put suddenly in charge of the entire household. And when there was water scarcity and people needed water, the guy was very dramatic. Sometimes he said yes, sometimes he said no. And when he says no, he says certain things that were very funny or like just catchy lines that people, just from time to time, it developed into some kind of social commentary. And they started making certain lines about it. And then it became a song and then it became a dance. And they just used it because, I mean, people needed anything to distract themselves from the horror that they were going through. And so that dance developed. But of course, not everything that developed during the war lasted up until today. Some of them, you know, were stopped immediately the war ended. But some of them survived, and that dance survived. According to me and some of the feedback I got during the interviews, largely due to the influence of the Catholic Church in the area, you know, because a lot of studies have shown how the war, for good or bad, helped the Catholic Church to increase its following across the former Eastern region. Not just the Catholic Church, but like entire Christian missionary enterprise, you know, they really used that opportunity to provide relief aid, to also teach the Bible and preach Christ and stuff like that. So the Catholic Church has now adopted that dance as part of its formation for young people, you know. And so that was, I think, a large part why that dance has survived to today. So I wanted to highlight that because, I mean, almost nobody that I had spoken to outside that community knew about this. But the community members, especially older generation, they knew this. Some of the little pamphlets and books that indigenes from there had written about the community when they are listing dances or listing cultural festivals, they name that dance and say it was created during the Civil War and all of that. So I took that as dance and then looked at how just the entire memory of the war is like, is not linear, it's not unidirectional, it's a bit here and there, you know, it's like wavy, like a dance. So that was just how I, you know, decided to say, okay, Dancing Memories exhibition, to both highlight this little known dance and just a metaphor for the way the memory of the war, of the Biafra war, has manifested.
That's honestly, as you keep talking, I am just so it's fascinating, this story. I want to ask, in all of this though, public engagement, and I know there would be a lot of stakeholder management and all of that, what were the challenges you actually faced in trying to engage the public, and how did you address them?
There were lots of challenges. Just starting off from the point where the Nigerian government has always clamped down on anything Biafra, its memory, its history, the name, you know, like in a lot of places where Biafra is discussed, you're like closely watched, if not like suspected and all of that. And I saw a lot of it like personally, you know, and it was sort of some kind of just security concerns. And I remember also when we were trying to print promotional materials, especially maybe some t-shirts and stuff, I was told not to write the name Biafra anywhere on the t-shirt, because then you might be putting a target on the back of anyone wearing it, you know. And that was a very, I was, I mean, that statement struck me. They said it in jest, but I was like, for real?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but yeah, people have been killed extrajudicially and accused. I mean, since IPOB was proscribed, you know, and labeled a terrorist group, I think it allowed the federal government some kind of leeway, you know, to take certain actions that are very, very questionable, you know, in that sense. And so the public, it would be foolish to then just put a target on somebody's back because they're wearing Biafra and maybe they say the wrong things to the police at the checkpoints, and, you know, that might just be the end or something. But so we had to navigate a lot of these things and just be clever with the way we did our promotions. We had to assure people. In fact, I remember one time the veterans we wanted to bring, because we always like paid for their transportation or even charter a bus for them and stuff like that. After agreeing to meet us on the day, half of them said they were no longer coming because they felt it was a setup by the federal government to have them arrested. I mean, I don't even know from where to where, how, I'm telling you, like, and it put us in panic mode because this was the D-Day. We needed to hear their stories. We wanted it to be a focus group rather than a one-to-one interview. And that was like the person who spilled the rumor just brought it from thin air, and everybody is scared. You know, there's this culture or atmosphere of fear that both the government and these non-state actors have sort of planted in that whole region. You know, so it was very frustrating that day. We had to give double assurances, triple assurances. You know, present my ID card, my letters of engagement, and I mean, it was a whole thing. Just on the security side, people being scared about talking or associating with anything Biafra, or I mean, it was a lot. But yeah, we had to be clever with a lot of and I mean, shout out to the guys at Center for Memories, because not being in Nigeria for a lot of the year, you know, so I visit Nigeria, say, for 2 months or 3 months, or maybe 6 months. But these guys, they live there. They see what's going on. I just read them in the news, but they live the news. So they were able to come up with innovative solutions that helped us to navigate a lot of those issues. The media as well, Afia TV, very instrumental. And so things went on. But sometimes I just pause and I imagine, you know, what if we had a much more friendly government, a much more or a less security contentious environment, you know, how would this project have gone? You know, would it have been bigger than this or smaller, or would it even be important to talk about? Because, I mean, everybody has finally, you know, gone through the entire process of transitional justice and now into full-fledged reconciliation. So sometimes I just think about what would have been if Nigeria wasn't as it is today.
Yeah, you had gone ahead to mention a few people that you worked with. I My next question was actually going to lead to that, the importance of the collaborations that you had, the support that you had, whether from institutions or from individual. How important was that to this project?
Oh, it was very key. I mean, I think that was demonstrated also in the award, you know, the collaborative aspect of my research. So funny thing is, before I actually finished my master's, I had visited this place for the first time because I saw it on Twitter. That's the Center for Memories in Enugu. And I'm like, wow, you know, these guys, they were doing something, I think, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the end of the war. That was 2020, yeah. So I visited. I mean, I really liked what I saw. It was a youth run. Like, all of them were like within my age bracket, you know, and very impressive and professional stuff those guys were doing. So I told them, you know what, I'll come back here to do like a long-term collaboration with you guys. I don't know what shape it's going to take. But I asked a lot of questions and I felt like, I mean, I need to collaborate with these people. And so even then, I didn't know that I was going to come to Cambridge. So when I got the admission and I was just preparing to leave, I visited them again, shared the news with them and said, okay, yeah, now I want to collaborate with you guys. I'm going to Cambridge. Hopefully that means there'll be a lot more resources, at least in terms of funding for projects like mine. And then, of course, exposure. Just we had to reach some kind of mutually beneficial, agreement that made a lot of sense both for my work and for the center as well. And so, when I finally returned for my fieldwork proper, they were very instrumental in helping in connecting me to sources because they've been the entire reason for their existence is to highlight Igbo history, Igbo culture and all that. So they've already had like partners, collaborators and key informants from around the world, you know. And then when it comes particularly to the Biafra war issue, they had lots of people as well. So they connected me to some of these people whom I hadn't met before. They gave me access to their documents and archival materials, their space, which was very key for a lot of the events that we did. And so it was just this, I would say, love at first sight, kind of from that first day I visited them till today. We've just been in this wonderful collaboration that has benefited put me and the center immensely. Even to the media side of things, they helped me get a lot of media attention because they already had media collaborators. So they just say, oh, we're doing an event, would you guys like to come around? And you know, they come around and then that opens the door for you to then make your own introductions and connections, you know. So it's been a very empowering collaboration, I would say.
Great, great. It's usually nice when you have that sort of support on ground. Yeah, it's usually very important. I was wondering, because I watched one of the YouTube videos on your on the site, the project site, and you had mentioned the War Museum, the National War Museum, as one of the approaches of the federal government to sort of tell the story. But you mentioned as well that there are challenges around how the war is being represented, and partly because of the military interference, because if I understood that, even though the museum is under the NCMM, the National Commission for Museums and Monuments, the military museum itself or the war museum has some sort of input from the military the army, right? I was wondering, do you see yourself engaging or collaborating with the military to change what you deem as challenging or misrepresenting or what? What's yeah, is such an engagement even possible? And if it was possible, how would you go about it?
Yeah, definitely. There's been, I think, so I published something on just this particular aspect of that war museum and how it wasn't a fair representation of the Nigerian Civil War. And others have also written similar things about the museum, which isn't surprising, actually. If you study lots of war museums around the world, there are lots of, lapses, representational lapses. I think the difference is that there is an unspoken unwillingness to do anything about it, especially from the government side. This was what I said in that article. I think it's just the military have used the museum as a way of just to show their might, like this is our Instagram page. You go and see the kind of weapons we had during the war. I'm telling you, that's really what they're doing there. And
I
so
see.
it's not really about the history or even the maybe sacredness of that memory, because it is sacred for both the Nigerian soldiers who died and the Biafran soldiers who died. If you understand what I mean, so there was death on both sides. So if you continue to treat it like this regional thing, Nadia thing, it doesn't really elevate the importance of what happened there, because people from different parts of Nigeria actually came into this region in their mind trying to stop their brothers from going away, from being deceived away from Nigeria. And the other people were fighting to defend their homeland, so at the end of the day, if you continue to treat it like this, oh, Nadia, can you make we just, then you're not, the problem is deep rooted. You have to just change the way you think about it. The museum's narrative, on its own, to be very fair to the Nigerian government and NCMM and the museum itself, is quite reflective of both sides, if you get my point. Like these stairs that
Fantastic.
I'm talking about, these stairs I'm talking about has on the left, the key actors on the Biafran side, and on the right, the key actors on the Nigerian side. And then in some of the images, you'd see maybe a Nigerian soldier during the war, or a Biafran soldier during the war. So it has that, and that's not really where the issue lies. I'm talking about just on a general, as a Nigeria as a government, or as a people. If we see the conflict, just at the abstract level, as something that is sectorial, or just say a section of the country, rather than our thing. So, for example, there is no Remembrance Day for that particular conflict. Like, this is the most significant war Nigeria has been in since its existence, that killed the most number of people since its existence, at least from the military. And all you have is an Armed Forces Remembrance Day that couples everything together. See, even if you are police, you are a Boy Scout, and you died in service of Nigeria, we are remembering you today. Okay, I mean, that's fine. But there is a particular, I mean, like, for example, the US has 9/11 separate from Pearl Harbor, separate from World War II Remembrance, separate from Holocaust. Like, I mean, so it shows that you put that in national consciousness. So I'm not really just speaking about the
I
museum's
see.
kine-kine itself. There are issues I can pick within that. But just broadly, if we change the way we look at the Biafra War, maybe that will now then spread down into things like the museum.
So I want us to go into some of your personal reflections and broader implications of this project, really. How has working on this project influenced your personal understanding of identity, memory, and history, really?
Well, that's a very good question. First of all, being a researcher from the particular community that I'm researching, that's, you know, being Igbo myself, I think it has had a lot of kind of a self-conscious effect where certain things, because I grew up in Lagos, we still live in Lagos till today. You know, growing up, you just saw yourself as Nigerian, this Lagos boy. And, you know, sometimes I remember when I went to the East for the first time, I was sort of otherized, you know, like this one is not pure Igbo, he's speaking small Yoruba or something, he cannot speak Igbo, you know, so all those things. I didn't quite understand my place. But when I was serving in Abeokuta, and you know, I was Igbo, whether or not I could speak Yoruba or I didn't really represent Igbo enough. So it was coming back to then study this, I sort of saw why. I understood a lot of, it added context to some aspects of my past that I didn't quite pay close attention to. So identity, history, and memory are closely intertwined. You know, people would, your identity can be derived from your history or from the memories of your past. And whether or not you want to be Igbo, once people think you are Igbo or you look Igbo, you are sort of covered with the Biafran history and its memory and its pros and cons, whether or not you like it, you know, like whether or not you associate with it or not, especially when you come into national prominence, you know. So I think it's just made some things clearer for me, you know. Now I see, I have a lens through which, okay, I understand what's going on here, and maybe I have to navigate it this way and not, you know, not just be naive about it, thinking that there's nothing. You know, I think there's something hanging over our heads just because of where we come from and something like that, especially in Nigeria and in relation to the Biafra War. It has created that kind of self-consciousness for me, and also deep appreciation for the culture. Again, I'm not sort of studying this just so that I can look at the political or economic or these other aspects of it and make a lot of arguments and all that. No, I'm looking at how heritage, you know, cultural memory, collective memory, memorial practices as well, have been shaped by the war. You know, so it has created like a new level of understanding of how conflict can impact on heritage for me as well. You know, I've learned so much just from this case study, and I think from the places I've also presented my work at, I think people willing to understand and appreciate the unique contributions that the Biafra War is making to the overall debate on conflict and heritage studies.
Given that violence is violence, right? And even though I want to just go with that saying, but I would like to actually ask you, is there a difference, right, between the civil war legacies of violence, yeah, and the colonial legacies of violence as we have it on cultural heritage. And what lessons can we learn from your studies? How can we apply the lessons from what you've done onto colonial legacy of violence in Nigeria? Are they lessons to be learned, and can we transfer those lessons when we're dealing with colonial histories or colonial legacies of violence?
So I think I would say yes and no for the first part of the question. If there's a difference, yes, there's a stark difference.
Okay.
Especially in relation to the Nigerian Civil War, to the Biafra War, there's most civil wars are fought from a political lens, from like a socio-political lens of like maybe territorial dispute or resource control, you know, governance issues, you know, and all that, rather than with an underlying, sometimes it's fueled by an underlying ethnic, you know, hate or bigotry, like the Nigerian Civil War wars as well. But on the colonial violence, a lot of the times are targeted specifically at crippling the culture. You know, it's like to be able to like to gain subservience from the people, you know, from the people it's targeting. And so to do that, they usually target the culture and the institutional guardrails within that culture so that they can replace it with their own and then effectively govern the people, you know.
If I understand you, sorry, you're saying that the colonial style was more directly, they were more direct in their attack of the cultural structure of the society, unlike the Civil War. Okay, all right.
Yes. So, for example, and this is a very hypothetical scenario because I wasn't there during the Biafra War or even during the say during the sack of Arochukwu or Benin and all that. So, but you know, I would imagine that a Nigerian soldier who had just conquered Nsukka would not care much for, you know, the shrine or the Igwe's palace. You know, they are going ahead to Enugu, where it is the seat of power of Biafra, to topple whoever is there and return Biafra back to Nigeria. You know, like that's really the goal of that war. Whereas a colonial soldier is targeting those things that they feel are your cultural institutions, that things that you fear or that you adore, that you revere. When they cripple those things, then they redirect that fear and reverence to themselves or to their own institutions, you know. So I think and that's really something that you need to do, say, in the introductory chapters of your writing, is to say what kind of violence or conflict are you even talking about? You know, there are different kinds of violence, but it's good to be situational, talk about what kind of violence you're exploring here and how the lessons might not apply to other cases, right? But I think overall, at the end of the day, one thing that ties these two different types of violence is the aftermath. You know, how do you take care of the aftermath? So post-colonial or post-civil war, post any kind of conflict, what steps are taken to repair the harm that was done. Yeah, I think that's really where both of them might align, you know, because in places where a lot of care was taken to repair such harm, there is greater harmony and less conflict in the future. You know, the legacies are not, the legacies of that violence do not kick off another cycle of violence down the line. So if you have a case of colonial violence that its aftermath was poorly handled, there was no attempt at repair or restitution or reparation at all, there will still be conflict, you know, even if it's not violent, even if it's not physical and visible, but there would still be harm and trauma and, you know, just the life cycle of that trauma and that pain and that harm would just continue to regenerate itself across generations, you know. I mean, now we're talking about the Benin Brothers, and many of the activists for that were not there when in 1897, right? But it's an injustice that has endured because the aftermath was not well, well addressed. The same thing for the Biafra War, for example. A lot of people have criticized the way the 3 hours of reconstruction, rehabilitation, and I think reintegration was conducted by Gowon, and how his speech on no victor, no vanquished was quite, not so true. So, yeah, I think maybe that's just one line that might tie both of them. But, yeah, I still maintain that they are very different and might actually require their own specific tailored, remedial approaches.
What message or lessons do you have for young researchers and heritage professionals who want to undertake similar projects?
I think the first thing would be to establish themselves within the target community or communities. So that even if you were an outsider, seek collaborations with insiders or communities that organizations that have those bridges between you and the communities. I think that's the first thing, you know, because you might be Igbo or Yoruba or Hausa or, you know, TV, but maybe within the part of TV or the part of Yoruba that you're working in, you're not really from that part, you know, you're not from the soil. And so you still face some insider-outsider dynamics as well, you know. So linking yourself first and foremost to either organizations or people that they trust, I think is the first thing, because that is also what your funders want to see, at least. Most of your funders want to see, oh, how are you better placed to carry out this research if we give you the money? And then you say, okay, this, I have this, I have that. And, you know, it puts a lot of your work in the realm of feasibility, in the realm of feasible, you know. So I think that would be the first thing to do, because that was the first thing I did. And it helped me tremendously. The second thing would be, of course, to find funding, because you could have a lot of ideas, very good ideas, but without funding, you know, research is not usually, not a lot of ideas during research can come true. So if you're lucky enough and you find good fundings, then that would help you to not just idealize your plans, but also try to bring a lot of those ideas into fruition. I'll say, and then maybe the third thing would be, and perhaps the final thing would be, to have an evidence-based approach to your engagement with communities, you know. I'll say, like, you know, sometimes you need to like research and see what has worked in other contexts, you know, and see how you could learn a few things from those contexts, with, you know, bearing in mind the unique context that you're working with. But if there are some transferable skills or ideas that you can pick from, say, a research in Brazil or a research in Togo, you know, you would go faster than trying to just come up with fresh new ideas on your own. So yeah, if you are looking to do public engagement work, see all other kinds of public engagement that have been done. I mean, I remember I love reading public engagement work in the public health sector. I think those guys are like they are one of the best you know, researchers that undertake public engagement work, you know, those in public health and diseases, you know, because they need to reach into these communities and talk about certain health issues, and so they adopt a lot of innovative ways, you know, and I've been inspired by their work as well. And then some of my colleagues here in Cambridge has that have worked on different aspects of indigenous heritage or something like that. So you just need to see what's going on around you and see how much of that you can execute with the funding you have or with the little resources that you have, and then collaborate with your communities. Because sometimes when you bring that idea, they'll tell you, ah, this one cannot work, or, and they know why it cannot work because they've been there, they know the people, and they will just give you their own. Sometimes the ideas are like much more fantastic than all these things you've seen online, you know. So I think those three should get them a very good head start.
What are your future plans for the this project?
Yeah, I actually would like to continue, especially the phase one part of the project, in terms of the questionnaires, the survey. I want to expand that beyond the Southeast region to maybe the South South or the Southwest or even the North, just to see what other Nigerians, what's their perception of the world, for example, and how maybe that might be feeding into the way that we manage or not manage the memory, you know, of the war. Because I know I've been in certain circles where, yeah, the way they talk about it, it's like the way maybe some of us too might talk about the Boko Haram war, you know, in the Northeast. It's like far away. You know, you're going to school, you don't know what's good. Like others are in IDP camps, but you're going to school because, of course, other parts of Nigeria were like getting on with their lives while for at least 3 years or something, this other region was under bombardment, you know. So, and you cannot blame them. It's like I said, I have somewhat the same kind of disposition towards the Boko Haram conflict or something else that is farther away from me. So, but I just think about it, and I would like to just know how that plays, you know, whether or not it plays into the overall national consciousness of the war. Yeah, and also, you know, interface with the National War Museum more. If, yeah, maybe even like you said, you know, find a way to take it up with the military, you know, see how we could conduct some advocacy there, even if just sitting down and discussing certain things, maybe hopefully that might open some doors. But yeah, I intend to continue the project because it has I think the biggest impact for me from the project has been among the young generation that, you know, like most of our participants, many of them say this is the first time. This is like there were many firsts, like multiple firsts for each person on something that is so ubiquitous. Like if you are Igbo or you are in Igbo land, even as a core member, I remember we had like two core members from other parts of Nigeria, you know, seven in Igbo land. I mean, you could always feel that tension. You could always feel something in the air about Igbo, or especially with now with the IPOB resurgence. You know, it affects you whether or not you like it. You know, there's that sit at home on Monday, or there's some, like, you know, it shapes your life consciously or unconsciously. And yet many of them know very little, very, very little about it. You know, which also meant that they were prone to radicalization. You know, it's like they could listen to certain voices or certain extreme narratives and then take up you know, certain positions that might be uninformed, you know. So I don't think, that's really the biggest driver of why I do the project, is to just speak with young people, see what they know, the sources of such knowledge, and just, you know, hopefully that might start a new thought process in them that, you know, gives birth to something better than what they already have.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Now, more generally, what are your aspirations for the cultural heritage space in Nigeria?
Well, I would really love to see more young people like you and me doing the work of cultural heritage in Nigeria. I'm always very, very dismayed by our poor performance on the World Heritage stage. You know, like you look at World Heritage site nominations and you see a lot of sites from other parts of Africa. You know, like they take it more serious than we do. They have like well-funded commissions and committees that look at their culture and their sites, manage them, and then nominate these things professionally. Not like I do not know that the World Heritage status comes with its own challenges, but even the intangible, the other one, the representative list of the intangible cultural heritage, which is the intangible aspect of the World Heritage list, we just have like a few festivals there. I think it's just the like two masquerade festivals and then some festivals. I think, it's very poor. I was expecting, okay, since maybe we do not have a lot of tangible physical structures still standing and intact, what of our cultures, our festivals, our food? You know, because you go to that list and you see a lot of food, a lot of even beer or coffee, you know, think indigenous foods and healing practices like acupuncture or maybe all these, you know, like so many things that we have, you know, in our own place. But we just haven't been able to package them well. And I think it's also as a result of, the, you know, a dearth of researchers and interested people, especially young people in that sector. So I'm hoping that in the very near future that more Nigerian youths will take up cultural heritage subjects, you know, like archaeology. You know, we have very few people studying archaeology, even fewer universities that even offer the course, you know. So, but it's not just archaeology, there's history, there's other, I think, other aspects of that can come together to uplift heritage and heritage management in Nigeria.
Thank you for your time. I look forward to the progress of your project and the opportunity to discuss it.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak about my work. And I really enjoy what you're doing, and you know, just the idea behind it all. It's really, really impressive, and more power to you and your team.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by African Heritage Nexus. For more content, please visit our website, africanheritagenexus.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time.